You're listening to the Connecting Industry podcast, brought to you by Connecting Industry. You can find out more about the resource and construction industry, including how to communicate consciously with your stakeholders at connectingindustry.com.au.
Welcome to the Connecting Industry podcast, brought to you by Connecting Industry. I'm Kieran Moran. The Connecting Industry podcast series is designed to tell the stories of the people who work in the resource and construction sector throughout Australia. It's our goal for these podcasts to not only keep you up to date with the latest resource and construction news, information and procurement opportunities, but most importantly, build relationships between you and our guests so you can connect with their stories and get a better understanding how to communicate and tell your business story right. On this week's Connecting Industry podcast, we have Tim Keefe, CEO of Atrua Performance Cultures, a company that's passionate about supporting the true growth of individuals, teams and organisations. Tim has an extensive background in operations, management and leadership with career foundations in the Australian military. Atrua Performance Cultures are an award-winning performance cultures consultancy that focus on behavioural change in organisations across strategy, culture, leadership, development and safety solutions. Welcome, Tim, to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Kieran. It's great to be here.
So as I said there, you're the CEO of Atrua Performance Cultures, and interesting company. But before we get onto the company, because it's a good way to lead into exactly who you are, and I think this will also describe the position that you do have with Atrua, it will sort of lead up to that in a way, and for our listeners to understand why you are the CEO in that respect. So I want to go back to the very beginning. And from what I can see from your education and so forth, you were very inspired in relation to the Australian Defence Force.
That's correct, yeah. I started my career, I guess, in the late 90s. I decided to join the Army straight after school. When I finished high school, I went straight to the Australian Defence Force Academy, ADFA, and completed my degree there. So I did a three-year degree there, and then straight across to the Royal Military College of Duntroon and completed my officer training there. So I really loved that. I had a fantastic career with the Army that was a bit over 22 years. Saw some amazing things, got to travel the world and do some great stuff. But it was a fantastic career, and I learned a lot, particularly around leadership and safety, which is what I've taken into my post-military career. But a great opportunity as a young man getting around to have some amazing leadership opportunities and get out there and really see the world. It was fantastic.
And that's actually what I wanted to come back to, I suppose. So Atrua Performance Cultures, it's leadership development, safety culture and so forth. And then we'll get into the business exactly in another few minutes. Mm. But as you said there, you started learning some of the leadership in the Army and you did a Diploma of Leadership and Management. What led you towards working in those sort of programs to know that leadership is something that you're interested in?
Yeah, it's funny actually. This is a bit of a good news story, I guess, for the Australian Defence Force and for Australian Army cadets. I actually did cadets at school. It was one of the activities on offer when I was at school, and I thought I'll give this a go for a year and see how it is. Funnily enough, I enjoyed running around the bush and playing army with my mates at school. What that actually gave me a taste of was a couple of things. Was the fact that I could live a life and I could do things that didn't involve me sitting behind a desk necessarily. So I could be out in the bush and enjoying things. But it also gave me that really early exposure to leadership. And so what I found was that as a, I must have been, 13, 14 year old, schoolboy, having my first opportunity to lead my peers and to really explore what leadership meant, what it gave me was a real taste of, hey, I can do this. I'm okay at this. And also, I've got a lot to learn, which was great. But that environment where I could really try it out in a low-stakes environment and really feel into my own kind of leadership, getting that opportunity at such a young age was really formative for me. And I really look back at that as a great opportunity.
Yeah, well, it definitely did. In respect to, as you said, you were, it's 22 years. Is that correct? 22 years you were in the Defence Force?
Yes.
Yeah, and you had a little bit of a stop there. We'll have a chat about that as well. But to the point of, being within the Defence Force and staying there as well and within that leadership, and it's a fantastic grounding in a way. It's only recently I spoke to another company, and he himself had been in the Australian Defence Force, or actually it was the New Zealand Defence Force, if I can remember correctly, and for probably around about 20, 25 years, and now he's a leader within his business and so forth. So what is it that the Army do give you? Because I suppose in as you are moving forward and you move up the ranks, it is all about working as a team, isn't it?
It is. That there's obviously working as a team is incredibly important. I think one of the key things, and a lot of people don't really understand this or hear this about military leadership, but military leadership is all about understanding your people first. And it's probably the first thing you get taught as a junior leader in the Army is you've got to know your soldiers, you've got to know your troops, and you want to know as much about them as you possibly can, because without knowing that, you can't really understand how they're going to perform, what their motivations are, what's going on in their lives. And so from a really early age, as a leader, we're encouraged to really engage at this deep personal individual level. And that's something that I think is really coming into its own in leadership these days when we look at sort of new leadership thinkers. But this idea of know your people first and know them so well that you can really understand how they're going to perform. That's something the military's been doing forever. And again, it was one of the first things I was taught as a junior leader to really engage at that individual personal level, which, stood me in really good stead.
And how did the soldiers take that on in relation to, because, especially, you got a lot of men and women within the Defence Force, but, as you said, to really, delve down and find out about the individual and what does motivate them. And, I suspect that a lot of the, especially the men and the male culture as it is and so forth, and the way sometimes they look at themselves is not to talk about themselves or not to realise their own vulnerabilities. And so how did you work with them to be able to get that out of them?
I guess there's an expectation there. So it's what I guess a lot of the soldiers are expecting. There's an expectation that as a junior officer, you know about your soldiers' lives, because there's a strong element, I guess, what you could call in terms of pastoral care almost, that's expected of junior officers to be able to understand the lives of their soldiers and support them with things that they might be really struggling with. So it's not uncommon for and it sounds a bit strange, but it's not uncommon for 22, 23 year old junior officer to be helping or supporting their soldiers through something like marriage difficulties, or that there's other things going on in their lives that are impacting them. You're expected as a leader to not necessarily have the answers, but to be able to support them and point them in the right direction. That can be pretty confronting, if you're young and you haven't actually got to that stage in your life where you've settled down and married and those sorts of things, and you start to see you've got a real role in supporting people through those really tough times in their lives, and that's just expected of what we do as Army officers.
Did you work with men and women?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. So I was a logistician, so my corps was the Royal Australian Corps of Transport. From a very all through my career, men and women in all my working environments, even when I was in combat roles, we had certainly had men and women in the unit.
It's a question that I will ask in another few minutes as well, just in relation to the men and women and the differences maybe in how you had to work with them. And I we're all human beings. A lot of us, we've all got the same fears and so forth, and issues that are coming onto us. They can claim that we're all individual as much as they like, and we are to a point, but at the same time, human beings are human beings. So it's a question I'll ask later. But as we started to go forward here in you working with the Australian Defence Force and so forth, so around about 2000, you started as a logistics officer for there, and then training manager and officer commanding at that time as well, a little bit forward up to about 2014. Then it looks like you got into some civilian life as a principal consultant for Disruption Group.
Yes. So my last real full-time job in the Army in sort of getting towards 2015, it would have been, I was instructing an Army base called the Land Warfare Centre in Canungra. And there I was doing a lot of leadership development work. It was around operational and tactical sort of planning for officers who were coming up and looking for promotion in the next sort of 12 months. And what that gave me insight to is to, first of all, that I really enjoyed that kind of work. So that development work was something I really enjoyed. And I was also getting to a stage where I was coming up on 20 years, and it was that stage where I was my family was starting to grow up a little bit, and I really wanted to actually look for something different. I was looking for a different way to sort of bring that to the world. And the disruption group really formed out of a few informal conversations over dinner a few times. Yeah, set myself up with a guy called Damien Corran, who, big shout out to Damien, he gave me my first break in business, which was great. Yeah, we set up the disruption group, and it was quite literally taking military leadership to a commercial setting. And yeah, that was a lot of fun for a couple of years.
And why'd you get out of it?
I think like a lot of businesses that when we started up, we forgot that we needed this thing called cash. After a while, we did a good job there. We had some great programs, but we didn't quite have the balance right in terms of marketing and bringing new work in, which is the eternal dilemma for consultants, is you're working and bringing work in at the same time. And so we brought the disruption group to a close a little time after that, but learned so much in those first probably 18 months or so about how to get that balance right. It's not just what you're delivering in terms of the quality of your products or service, whatever you're doing, but it's everything else around business management, and cash flow in particular was a real one for us. Yeah, things like marketing and actually getting the word out there and not relying just on one or two key contracts, which is the first mistake that we made.
Yeah, okay then. And so after that, of course, you went back into the Defence Force and so forth, and worked your way up into a number of different areas. But we'll get to project manager. You were for Disrupted Learning Project. And so that was the Australian Army, of course. And then you moved into Actua Performance Cultures. Now, I suppose with the disruption group and learning how to do business then, that sort of gave you a little bit of a step up to understanding a lot of people in business and some of the issues that they, face every day.
Absolutely. And there was, one of those formative experiences around what it's like to run a small business. I was probably a bit naive stepping out of the Army and stepping straight into a small business. Another quick lesson there was that my wife had actually just left corporate and set up her own business at the same time. Strongly recommend people don't do that. Both leave corporate jobs and set up businesses at the same time. That was a lot of pressure on the family, unfortunately. But yeah, it gave me a real insight and actually a real passion for that small, medium enterprise business. I mean, there's so many people in Australia who are engaged in small businesses, either as small business owners or employees. It's such a huge part of our economy and a huge part of our working experience is to be part of those businesses. So I think that's those first couple of years with the disruption group really gave me a very, I guess, acute understanding of what that business is like and a real passion to work in that space.
Yeah, and so we'll get into that space now. So Actura Performance Cultures, so leadership development, performance culture as well, of course, which I'm sure leads into leadership development as well, and safety leadership, and there's also coaching within there. Now, for people that don't know, Actura Performance Cultures, they work across a number of sectors, but you have worked quite across the area that we're talking about, the resource and construction sector. Glencore, you've worked with, Aurizon as well, BHP as well, and a number of others. So you're into the area that a lot of our listeners do work in. But okay, let's get on to Actua Performance Cultures. Tell us just the quick snapshot of it, and then we'll start talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're a performance culture business, and what we know is that performance culture looks different to most businesses we work with. And what we like to be able to do is to work with you to understand what it is that you're looking to achieve as a business and how can we help you get there. And the tools that we use for that typically are those culture tools, those levers around leadership, coaching. But safety is so prominent, particularly in the resources sector, and we work in a lot of other hazardous industries. And we're really passionate about making sure that people go home safe at the end of each day, and understanding how we can actually have that impact in a sustainable and effective way across a business. That's really what drives us in our safety programs. We talk about safety as being not about what are you safe from, like not what are the hazards that are out there, but what are you safe for? And when we can really connect to that, that's when we start to see sustained changes in behaviour around safety, because we're no longer worried about what is out there. We're actually deeply emotionally connected to why we make safe decisions. And that's where we start to see real changes in behaviour. And to be perfectly honest, that's why we do it. We talk about changing lives every day. And that's what we do in our programs.
So changing behaviours, and so like you said, the why we should be safe, which is an interesting way to go about it. And so I'm interested to know, what are some of the reactions you get there? Because, yeah, of course, we all got to go to work and be safe, but the whole point is to be able to come home to the family, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I guess that's one of the things that comes out a lot in the programs is everyone's motivations are different, and we take people through an activity which some of your listeners may be familiar with around what we call the top four, and it's connecting to the top four things that are most important in your life that you want to be safe for. And one thing that always interests me with top four when we do it is the variety of things that people want to be safe for. And you can tell, yeah, there's a certain age at which people have got family and kids and those sorts of stuff. And unsurprisingly, they are absolutely up there in top four. Some of the other things that people put in their top four, it really opens us up to, say, different lifestyles. So for some people, getting out on their jet ski is in their top four. Or for some, I've heard some guys come back and say, oh, I love going going pigging on the weekend with my mates. And, I never want to do anything to compromise that. It's like, great. If that's what motivates you to stay safe, that's what we need to talk about. And it's just being open to the fact that, I'm a father and I've got a family. That's what motivates me to be safe. But there's no point in me saying, well, you need to be safe to go home to your family. Well, what if they don't have a partner and kids at home? What if they're disconnected from their family? What is it that actually you want to be safe for? Because it's actually different for everyone.
We've talked about safety quite a bit on this podcast, of course, because it's the resource and construction sector. We've had a number of training organisations on the podcast over the last few years, and it's interesting to hear where a lot of it comes from in relation to, why people should be safe on site. Now, we also, of course, in the past, and it still happens with a lot of, safety, a lot of companies claim for it to be important. We were even talking about just yesterday with a group of friends, safety in relation to, the Empire State Building, actually, it was over in the United States, and they're one of the first businesses to actually talk about safety at that time. And the main reason it was they were doing that is it was costing them too much for the people that were dying on site. Now, I sort of say that as an offshoot in relation to, a lot of it, for some people who are running the business or involved in the business or project managers, that's what it's about in some respects. But fundamentally, really, and as we've talked about in the past as well, is it is about leadership, isn't it? So how important is leadership when it comes to, delivering safety, not just on site, but in any workplace?
Oh, absolutely critical. This is where, I guess, safety thinking has really transformed over the last couple of years. We've had this period of, what we might call behaviour-based safety, which is trying to control the behaviours of our workforce, of our teams, to say you must do this and don't do that. And we know that works to a certain extent, but it's not particularly effective over the long term. What does make a difference is a leadership environment where people feel that safety is just the way we do things around here, because I'm personally committed to it for my own reasons, but I'm also committed to it for my mates and my workmates. Now, if as a leader you can't connect your team to the importance of safety in terms of making those safe decisions for what's important in my life, you're going to be fighting an uphill battle. As a leader, we also need to be open to this idea of creating what's called psychological safety, which is it's a term that's thrown around a lot these days. But what it really means is that when you create an environment where your team is willing to come to you with challenges or willing to speak up, that's when you know when you're starting to really create a really positive culture around not only safety, but also performance and leadership. Because if, as a lot of leaders have done in the past, if your team relies on you to have all the answers, you're not using the full capacity of your team. What's more, as the leader, you're putting everything on you. It means you can never go on holidays. It means that whenever you make a mistake, the team makes a mistake. And it puts you at the center of everything. And anyone who's been in that position, it's incredibly exhausting. And I stick my hand up to say I've made that mistake plenty of times in my leadership development. But the more that we can create teams that are deeply engaged with performance and safety, the less stress there is on the leader, because the team itself knows what to do and they're willing to speak up. They've got a leader who's willing to listen to them and a leader who's actually willing to take action, because lots of leaders listen or say they listen, but then actually following through with action, that's sometimes the really hard bit about that.
As you said there as well, it can be exhausting and if they haven't got the team behind them and so forth. And that's sort of one of the true challenges of any leadership. And, you see across social media, you know, the comments in relation to, the memes, I suppose, in relation to leadership. And, a lot of it's just a passing message. And a lot of us, like you said, psychological safety before, it's get thrown around. But what's the real meaning of it? Okay, fundamentally, so we're coming towards the end of the podcast, but I would like to know in relation to, you know, what makes a good leader? And, well, you know, there's many things, so you can't answer that very quickly, but to the point of what are some of the fundamental things that where, you know, you might already be doing a workshop with a leader. They already might be in charge of a number of people, but then they're surprised about something and something they had never thought of what truly can take their leadership to the next level.
We could do a whole series on that. I think it's a great question. I guess there's a few things that come to mind straight away. And this speaks a lot to the structure that we put into our programs, is that we always start with the leader. We always start with some form of self-awareness. And we quite often call that like a leading self module, or understanding ourselves better. So I've never come across a leader who couldn't do with more awareness about how they're experienced as a leader. And I strive for this all the time in my own, in our business, to better understand how I'm experienced as a leader, because we all have good intent. I fundamentally believe this, that there's not too many people out there who wake up in the morning and say, how can I mess up the day for everyone else around me? Pretty much everyone has positive intent. And even as leaders, now, if you've got a crummy leader or a crummy boss you're working for, just think about, do they actually wake up in the morning thinking, I want to be like that, or is this just how they're experienced? And it's this gap between intent and impact, which is so fundamental to being an effective leader. So I think the first thing is, as a leader, trying to close that gap between intent and impact is probably the first most important thing we can do. Probably the second thing, and I'll stick to two, is to be curious. And I think as leaders, if we can just be more curious about our teams, about our work, about safety, about performance, whatever it is, get curious about what needs to change. Get curious about how can we do things better. Get curious about your people. Learn to ask better questions. And then listen to the answers, which is incredibly important. But there's a great concept from a guy called Michael Bungay Stanier.
I listened to Michael and read a few of his books myself.
Oh, MBS is fantastic.
He's an Australian too.
I absolutely love his work. Yeah, I highly recommend his work to any leader out there. The Coaching Habit, I think, is one of the best leadership books you can go and grab right now. Not getting any royalties there from MBS, but if he wants to, he can find me. He has this great phrase: "Stay curious just a little bit longer." And I think that's, as leaders, if we can just stay curious about our people, about performance, about safety, about what we're doing in the world, that curiosity just opens us up to so many more possibilities. Yeah, if we can understand the gap between intent versus impact, and just stay curious a little bit longer, most of us can do with more of that, I think. there's not too many people I've met who that doesn't resonate with.
It's interesting. Before this podcast, I was thinking of getting, I've got about two or three of his books, actually, Michael Bungay-Stanier, and I was thinking, oh, I should get out that book and ask him some questions from there, but I decided not to, and you would have been able to answer them anyway, I think. Well, thank you very much, Tim, for joining us on the Connected Industry podcast. Much appreciated. For those that want to get in contact with Actrua Performance Cultures, and believe you me, they're award-winning as well around the world. We're actually speaking to Tim. He's in Brussels right now to that point, so again, thank you, Tim, for calling us up from Brussels. But if you do want to get onto them, it's actrua.com.au. So that's actrua.com.au. Thank you very much, Tim, for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Kieran. It's a pleasure to chat to you from the early hours over here in Brussels. And thanks for the opportunity to have a chat with your listeners.
You've been listening to the Connecting Industry podcast interview series with Kieran Moran from Connecting Industry. If you want to find out more about the resource and construction industry, including past podcasts, news and events, go to connectingindustry.com.au.